Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, the search resumes in the southern Indian Ocean for a missing Malaysia Airlines jet. North Korea launches mid-range missiles, and we hear why Philippine fishermen remain wary of entering contested waters. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. Malaysia says recent satellite images have spotted 122 possible objects related to the search for the wreckage of a missing Malaysia airliner in the southern Indian Ocean. The search resumed today with 12 aircraft and naval vessels from China, Australia, the United States, Japan, South Korea, and New Zealand scouring waters 2,500 kilometers west of Australia. Ron Corbin reports that as the search for flight MH370 goes on, aviation analysts say the investigation will likely trigger calls for reform in air security and communications.
A total of 7 military and 5 civilian aircraft from 6 nations took to the skies over the southern Indian Ocean Wednesday as weather conditions improved, renewing the search for the Malaysian Boeing 777 that disappeared on March 8 with 239 passengers and crew on board. Australia's Maritime Safety Authority says vessels from Australia and China, the polar supply vessel Zhu Long, were 2,500 kilometres west of Perth, searching some 80,000 square kilometres. Australia's HMAS Success was sweeping a region where an Australian P3 Orion aircraft had sighted possible debris 2 days ago. In the Australian Parliament Wednesday, Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott renewed a pledge to Malaysia in the efforts to locate the last position of the aircraft.
I have pledged to Prime Minister Najib Razak of Malaysia full Australian cooperation in the recovery and investigation operation. The crash zone is about as close to nowhere as it's possible to be, but it's closer to Australia than to anywhere else.
Mr. Abbott moved a motion of condolence to those lost, while families of 4 Australians on board the ill-fated flight sat in the visitors' gallery.
4 Australian families have an ache in their heart. Nothing we say or do can take that ache away. Still, the knowledge that this nation, through this Parliament, has paused to acknowledge that loss may be of some comfort in facing this terrible bereavement. May God bless you at this very sad time.
Australia is easing visa and immigration procedures to enable families, especially from China, to travel to Perth, Australia, the centre of search and recovery efforts. In Perth, the local Chinese community has offered to assist the visitors. Of the 227 passengers on board, some 153 were Chinese. Oliver Lamb, managing director with Sydney-based Pacific Aviation Consulting, says he remains optimistic search efforts will succeed in locating the missing aircraft.
Too much of an industry riding on what happened here. Everybody in it, in whatever country, absolutely put safety first. And I'm almost certain that every effort, every human possible effort to get that black box, all those black boxes, I should say, will actually happen.
So far, little is known why less than an hour after departing Kuala Lumpur for Beijing, MH370 veered west as its flight transponder stopped transmitting. Only communication pings from the plane's engines provided clues on the aircraft's direction. The Malaysian government, aided by a British satellite tracking company, has narrowed down the aircraft's final position in the southern Indian Ocean, far from land. Lamb says the aviation industry is set to ensure aircraft can be tracked at all times.
It seems to me odd in the 21st century that a plane can go missing for so long. The ability to track planes irrespective of what goes on in a cockpit or the like, I think, is a big step that the industry is going to have to make.
Initial fears of a terrorist takeover of the flight came after it was revealed that at least 2 passengers were travelling by way of Beijing to Europe under false passports. Hugh Ritchie, a managing director with Aviation Consultants International, says from improved passport monitoring to security affecting communications are all set to come under the spotlight as the industry comes to grip with the issues surrounding flight MH370.
There's a multitude of areas which need to be reviewed. We're talking about aviation security, border controls. We're talking about integrated safety management systems. We're changing the black box so that it has a greater capacity to be tracked on board, capacity to turn off voice recorders, cockpit data recorders.
More than 25 countries have backed the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines jet, backed by some of the most sophisticated satellite and search technology in the world. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, a new report looks at the deadly risks of air pollution. Today, North Korea fired two suspected Rodong ballistic missiles about 650 kilometers off its eastern shore. Pyongyang's latest missiles into the Sea of Japan have drawn international criticism and come amid ongoing U.S.-South Korean military exercises. They also follow U.S. President Barack Obama's trilateral meeting Tuesday on North Korea with the South Korean and Japanese leaders in The Hague.
Over the last 5 years, close coordination between our three countries has succeeded in changing the game with North Korea. And our trilateral cooperation has sent a strong signal to Pyongyang that its provocations and threats will be met with a unified response, and that the U.S. commitment to the security of both Japan and the Republic of Korea is unwavering, and that a nuclear North Korea is unacceptable.
South Korea denounced the launches. A foreign ministry spokesman said they were a violation of the UN Security Council's resolution prohibiting all activities related to ballistic missiles. He says the missiles threaten international navigation and civilian safety because they took place without prior warning.
특히 이번 북한이 탄도미사일 발사는
He says the launches ignore calls for North Korean denuclearization and only heighten regional tensions. The North's action also came at a particularly sensitive time in South Korea, which today marked the fourth anniversary of the sinking of the Cheonan, killing 46 sailors. Seoul blames Pyongyang for attacking the boat. The North denies any involvement in the 2010 incident. Japan, which is resuming bilateral talks with North Korea in Beijing Sunday, called on Pyongyang to demonstrate restraint, while the United States described the rocket launches as a troubling and provocative escalation of tensions. Brad Glosserman, executive director of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum, an Asia defense think tank, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Rodong is a medium-range missile and says it has been years since they were launched.
These could be used to deliver a nuclear warhead, but that would require North Korea to be able to miniaturize its nuclear technology, and there's no indication as yet that they can. But given the fact that these have ranges of about 800 miles, they could in fact reach Japan, Tokyo, and military bases within Japan. So they are potentially very destabilizing and potentially very threatening.
I'm wondering if these launches may jeopardize any efforts at normalizing relations between the North, South Korea, and Japan.
No. They don't jeopardize, I think, that because I don't think there was a lot of progress in store. You've seen some tentative steps forward by North and South Korea in the terms of these family reunions, some talks about perhaps institutionalizing some discussions. You've seen some movement on the part of the North to soften the hard line, its absolutist position against South Korea, and to perhaps engage President Park. You've seen, as we mentioned, I think there have been some quiet meetings between Japanese and North Korean diplomats in Beijing and in Mongolia. I think those had a very, very, very long way to go before there'd be a payoff. So to argue that these launches jeopardize their outcomes is premature. I think says too much. But without question, these launches complicate and remind both of these governments that North Korea remains problematic.
One analyst in Seoul suggested the tests are a carefully calibrated show of force for the benefit of the leaders who were meeting at The Hague on Tuesday.
Without question, it was a signal to them that North Korea remains a country to be reckoned with, that it will continue to impose itself on discussions upon what, even if it is not invited or at the table, and that it, no one can afford to take it for granted or take them for granted.
Brad Glosserman of the Pacific Forum. Tufts University Korean Studies Assistant Professor Sunyoung Lee tells Victor Beatty the rocket launches are North Korea's way of saluting significant events, such as the trilateral meeting at The Hague involving President Obama, South Korean President Park Geun-hye, and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. It is the first meeting between the leaders of Japan and South Korea in 2 years.
North Korea has done things like this in the past. For example, America's Independence Day in 2006, local time in Washington, 3 p.m. or so on July 4th, North Korea fired off 7 missiles, including a long-range ballistic missile. North Korea is very good at timing, rubbing it in, if you will, adding insult to injury. And this is a way for North Korea to remind the United States and Japan and South Korea that it is a political factor to be reckoned with, that it cannot be ignored. And raising the stakes by test-firing a ballistic missile, which indeed, of course, technically is a violation of several UN Security Council resolutions, North Korea is trying to put pressure on Washington and Tokyo and Seoul to go to return to talks. And out of the trilateral meeting, I suppose there was some discussion of convening a trilateral meeting among those three nations, a meeting of the chief delegates to the so-called six-party talks. North Korea, you know, has a keen sense of timing, and I would not just simply say that this was a reaction to the combined military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea.
From Seoul's perspective, how do you think the meeting at The Hague went with Japan's Prime Minister Abe? Was Ms. Park very happy with it?
Probably South Korea was as happy as it reasonably expected the meeting to be. I don't think South Korea had expectations that Prime Minister Abe would be forthcoming on historical issues or territorial issues, which are important issues for South Korea on an emotional and political level. So the common threat of China and North Korea is what was emphasized by the U.S. in trying to bring the two allies in Northeast Asia together. In that context, in terms of U.S.-led alliance structure in Northeast Asia, that primarily seeks to contain the threat from communist China and North Korea. In that context, nothing's really changed since the first such effort by the U.S. to arrange for a meeting between South Korea and Japan, which took place in 1951 during the Korean War.
Sunyoung Lee says it is about time that Seoul and Tokyo improve what he describes as fluctuating bilateral relations over their colonial and wartime past. He says while history is not easily forgotten, they must focus on their common present and future interests, including the strategic threats posed by North Korea and China. In Tokyo, Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, was asked by Victor Beatty if the Park Abe meeting turns a corner in bilateral ties.
It at least moved the relation farther along. Whether or not it turned the corner remains to be seen. But certainly the mere fact that they did meet, and also that the U.S. did play a role in encouraging this, is a good thing. It will take some time, I think, to overcome the current sort of spate of animosity, most of it coming from South Korea. But it's a step in the right direction. And one does note that although the focus and the headlines are on how bad the South Korea-Japan relationship is, that there is always, at various levels, there are certainly reasonable voices on both sides. You particularly would see this in the military-to-military relationship, although it is somewhat limited for political reasons, mostly on the Korean side. But it's a good thing, and it often a small step leads to greater improvement down the road. And certainly the last couple years have been a rough patch, but things change, and there is some grounds that this could I think it would certainly improve over the next few years. But it's a good first step.
Much has been made about Mr. Abe's visit to the Yasukuni War Shrine. That was in December, several months ago now. Do you expect him to, quote-unquote, watch his P's and Q's in the future if he hopes to improve ties with Seoul?
I think he will. The message was certainly conveyed, I think, by the Americans, but also within Abe's own circles, that sort of respected people, you know, advised him that, you know, for whatever reason, you know, he may have very good reasons for going, but there's far more to be gained by restraining himself. And I think that message has been received. It does not mean that Mr. Abe will, you know, do whatever outsiders tell him to do. He is the prime minister of a democratic country. But I think that there's an understanding that there's more to be gained by watching what he does and what he says.
Grant Newsham of the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. The Yasukuni Shrine, which honors Japan's nearly 2.5 million war dead, including 14 convicted World War II war criminals, is viewed as a symbol of Japan's militaristic past. Mr. Abe said his visit was not meant to hurt the feelings of Japan's neighbors, but was a sign of respect for his country's war dead. The Korea Times today reports Ms. Park has refused to meet with Mr. Abe over his lack of contrition for Japan's imperial-era misdeeds. The Times quotes a Seoul University analyst as saying, if Mr. Abe revisits the shrine, the trilateral meeting will be the last between President Park and Mr. Abe as heads of state. The World Health Organization reports air pollution is now the world's largest single environmental health risk. A new report finds 7 million people died from exposure to air pollution in 2012, more than double the number previously estimated in 2008. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Air pollution is a global problem. The World Health Organization reports 1 in 8 people around the world die from air pollution. It says new data show people exposed to indoor and outdoor air pollution die prematurely from cardiovascular diseases such as strokes and ischemic heart disease, as well as chronic pulmonary diseases and cancer. The World Health Organization reports most deaths from air pollution occur in low and middle income countries in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific, where about half the world's population cook and heat their homes using open fires and simple stoves. Health officials say the use of coal and biomass fuels such as wood, animal dung, and crop waste is responsible for 4.2 million people dying prematurely in 2012. They link an additional 3.7 million deaths in urban and rural areas to outdoor air pollution. WHO Public Health, Environmental and Social Determinants of Health Coordinator Carlos Dora says clean air cannot be bought in a bottle.
To resolve this issue, it's quite important that countries, nations take action, which is more or less coordinated. And the reason for that is that the airshed small particles travel thousands of kilometers, normally around the hemisphere traveling east. So pollution in one country will affect a number of other countries downwind.
Dr. Dora says air pollution used to be worse in developed than in developing countries, but he says developed countries, notably the United Kingdom and United States, have taken action which has dramatically reduced air pollution during the past decade.
We know that those interventions work on energy, especially on transportation, better engines, cleaner fuels, more efficient energy technologies, reduction in the need for the use of energy, insulation of houses, etc., clean energy, solar, wind, energy that doesn't use combustion is better than those that do use combustion.
Dr. Dora says in most cases, healthier air pollution strategies will be more economical in the long run because healthcare costs will go down. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Almost 2 years ago, ships from China and the Philippines held a months-long standoff at a disputed shoal in the South China Sea. This week, some local fishermen are still staying away. Simone Orendine visited Masinloc, a town on the shores of the South China Sea, and has this report.
Macario Sepulveda has been fishing in the South China Sea for more than 30 years. He says the vessel he regularly captains used to go to Scarborough Shoal regularly until about 2 years ago. Sepulveda says the smaller survey boats that communicate with the mothership about the most abundant area next to the shoal are being driven away by Chinese surveillance ships. He says, whenever we would take home our catch, the light boat would be left behind in the middle of the sea. And if the water got choppy, they were able to get inside the shoal and take shelter. Now they can't. Sepulveda says the area surrounding the shoal, locally known as Bajo de Masinloc, is fraught with choppy waves that can easily whip around a smaller boat. Now, he says the vessels do not go beyond 55 kilometers outside the shoal, which has significantly reduced their catch from that area. Masinloc Town's fishery officer, Jerry Escape, says 10 fishing teams used to go out to Scarborough Shoal, which is 225 kilometers west of the town. Now, he says just 3 ships can afford to make the trip.
The problem is the expenses when they go there. It's too big. Since they spent that much, they feel that they are very poor when they go back here without anything to sell.
Escape says one fishing trip, which lasts about a week or so, can run about $2,000. A typical catch is 1 ton, and the fish can sell for $2.20 or $3.30 per kilo. Escape says fishing is one of 3 main industries in the town, and the local government is trying to remedy the dilemma by putting up fish habitats closer to shore to attract fish. The Philippine government maintains that the shoal is well within its 370-kilometer exclusive economic zone in accordance with international law. But China, which calls it Huangyan, says it has indisputable sovereignty over South China Sea islands and their adjacent waters, Huangyan Island included. Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Taiwan also have partial or total claims in the sea, which has abundant fish stocks, is a major trade route, and is believed to hold vast hydrocarbon reserves. In recent years, China has stepped up policing of these waters. In late January, fishermen from Masinloc reported to the Philippines military that a Chinese surveillance ship used a water cannon to drive them away. Manila lodged a protest with Beijing over the incident. A month later, China's foreign ministry said it had driven back some vessels from the Philippines, bringing what it says were construction materials to Second Thomas Shoal, another contested formation in the sea just west of Palawan province. The Philippines sent another protest, maintaining it was well within its rights to send provisions to its military personnel stationed at the shoal. In January last year, the Philippines filed an international arbitration case over what it calls China's excessive claims to practically the entire South China Sea. China, which bases its claim on ancient maps, rejects the filing and has not responded to it. The government is submitting supporting materials to the tribunal this week. In its case, the Philippines raises the question of whether rocks and submerged features, which it says are part of its continental shelf, can be claimed by anyone else. Scarborough Shoal is among its list of rocks. In May last year, the Philippines Coast Guard set up an office in Masinloc, which covers a 50-kilometer stretch from north to south of small fishing towns. Rogelio Casupang is commander of the substation.
My task, ma'am, is to advise the fishermen.
He says, for now, while the issue is still heated, they tell fishermen not to go out to Scarborough so they can avoid any confrontations. Masinloc's mayor, Desiree Adora, says the presence of the Coast Guard has helped give some fishermen peace of mind. She also says she hopes the dispute between the two countries will have a peaceful outcome and will result in mutual respect. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Masinloc, Zambales Province, the Philippines.